provide water for the keeping alive of a human being,
يجب بذله لإبقاء البهيمة المحترمة وإن كانت ملكا للغير.
It is wajib, it is also wajib for you to keep an animal alive, even though that animal be the property of somebody else's.
And that's why we have a responsibility towards our animals where it comes to preparing food, water, a nice place, security. Even here, Ayatollah Jawadi Amali, he says, and also harmony and peace, that the animal is comfortable in the place that it is living in. Which explains to us, اتقوا الله فيما خولكم. Be wary of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the responsibility that He has entrusted upon you when it comes to the rights of feeding, when it comes to when to feed.
أَلَا تَتَّقِ اللَّهِ فِيهَا إِمَّا أَن تَعْلِفَهَا وَإِمَّا أَن تُرْسِلَهَا حَتَّى تَبْتَغِي لِنَفْسِهَا.
Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi saw an animal tied up and no one was taking care of it. And Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam said, أَلَا تَتَّقِ اللَّهِ فِيهَا.
Where is your fear of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Either feed it or let it go so it can find its own food, its own water.
And many of these ahadith that speak about how we need to give them good quality food as well. Good quality food also. Inshallah, we will continue on in the next episode to talk about the rights of animals. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wassalatu wassalamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi tahirin.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams. Hear the children scream.
There Was the Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Roll your eyes, seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wasalam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
زيارة of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam.
السلام عليك يا مولاي موسى بن جعفر ورحمة الله.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners. I'm your host, Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam. Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. And Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam was also the seventh divinely appointed imam from among the household of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. Now, it is interesting to know that Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam was the testamentary trustee, and he was the seventh divinely appointed successor, vice regent, imam of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam was also the testamentary trustee and the only successor of the sixth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ja'far ibn Muhammad as-Sadiq alayhi salam. It is interesting, but we find in the life of Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam that he went through great ordeals, difficulties, trials, tribulations, troublesome afflictions, and it was not limited to these. Matter of fact, Imam al-Kazim was held hostage in prisons. He was put through pain and torture, and it can be said that he was very much like the Messiah, Isa ibn Maryam, in his devotions, his piety, and his asceticism. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام: تمثلت الدنيا للمسيح عليه السلام في صورة امرأة زرقاء، فقال لها: كم تزوجتي؟ فقالت: كثيرا. قال: فكل طلقك؟ قالت: لا، بل كلا قتلت. قال المسيح عليه السلام: فويح لأزواجك الباقين، كيف لا يعتبرون بالماضين.
Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam stated, the world was embodied to Jesus alayhi salam in the form of a blue-eyed woman. And he said to her, how many have you married? She said, lots. So he asked, so all of them divorced you? She replied, no, rather, I killed all of them. Then Jesus said, woe upon your current spouses, for how do they not take a lesson from your previous ones?
Welcome back, dear friends. It's an honor to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. We find that Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam, this divinely appointed imam from the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household, this divinely appointed imam spoke about belief. He spoke about belief in his conversations and his dialogues. with his companions and his friends and his relatives and the people in general. In one such beautiful conversation, when the companion of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam asked the holy Imam about belief and what a believer is and what a believer is like and, you know, some of the characteristics and qualities of a believer, we find that His Eminence, the seventh divinely appointed Imam, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam, replied, "The believer is stronger than the mountain. One can take something of the mountain with a pickaxe, but nothing can take anything of the believer's religion." And so here, dear brothers and sisters, we find such a beautiful statement. You know, sometimes we see or we read that one of the qualities of a believer is that they are as strong as a mountain, meaning that nothing can shake them. But here we find that Imam al-Kadhim says that a believer is stronger than a mountain. For you can go and take a pickaxe and remove things or minerals or parts of this mountain, but there is nothing that can come and take away from the faith and the religion of a believer. So a believer is so strong that if trials and tribulations, if problems, if calamities, if difficulties or ease beyond what is normal comes about for a believer, then a believer's religion, a believer's faith, a believer's iman goes untouched. And so every single one of us can be stronger than a mountain, in the sense that we should be such kind of believers that when different problems and hardships come our way, it doesn't reduce us when it comes to our religion and our faith. We must remain strong in our faith. We must remain strong in our religion, all in order to be known as believers. And of course, it is the believers whose end will be good, both in the world and in the hereafter. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Hamza Saudagar.
The aspect of, or I should say, one of the aspects that made the imamah of Imam al-Kadhim, salamullah alayhi, very critical is the conditions that ended up being the conditions of the ummah and the conditions of the movements of the Ahlul Bayt during that period. Yet we see he made very strong remarks against the regime, against Harun, against his predecessor. Harun was not the only Abbasid Khalifa during the time of Imam al-Kadhim. There were one or two other Khalifas after Abu Ja'far al-Mansur, one or two other Khalifas that ruled. Imam al-Kadhim, salamullah alayhi, was open in his stance against the government. Imam al-Baqir, Imam Zain al-Abidin, salamullah alayhima, which in certain ways their time was similar to the time of Imam al-Kadhim, in that the movement against the Umayyads was not a strong movement. They were starting it, and so it wasn't at a point where it was going to reach its goal. When they started that movement, they didn't have those, they didn't take those open stances against the Umayyads in a very provocative way. They didn't do that. This doesn't mean they didn't take public stances against the Umayyads. They did. That's recorded in history. However, the way those public stances were taken, you can do it in a provocative way, and you can do it in a non-provocative way. Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at farstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
In the limelight. For the first 2 years of the coronavirus pandemic through to 2021, China's growth was always positive and greater than that of the United States. China's policy not only saved lives but protected the economy. One might say win-win. We're prepared for you an article written by John V. Walsh. Until recently, a professor of physiology and neuroscience at the University of Massachusetts, Chan Medical School. The piece is titled COVID Death Toll versus China's Puts US to Shame. May and June, two milestones were passed in the world's battle with COVID-19 and were widely noted in the press, one in the United States and the other one in China. They invite a comparison between the two countries and their approaches to combating the pandemic. The first milestone was passed on 12th of May, when the United States registered more than 1 million total deaths due to COVID-19, the highest of any country in the world. WebMD expressed this sentiment in a piece headlined, US COVID deaths hit 1 million. History should judge us. Second, on 1st of June, China emerged from its 60-day lockdown in Shanghai in response to an outbreak there, the most serious since the Wuhan outbreak at the onset of the pandemic. The total number of deaths in mainland China since the beginning of the epidemic in January of 2020 now stands at 5,226 as of 19th of June 2022. To put that in perspective, that is 3,042 deaths per million population in the US versus 3.7 deaths in China due to COVID. 3,042 versus 3.7. Had China followed the same course as the US, it would have experienced at least 4 million deaths. Had the US followed China's course, it would have had only 1,306 deaths in total. The European Union did not fare much better than the United States, with 2,434 deaths per million population as of 19th of June this year. When confronted with these numbers, the response of the Western media has all too often been denial that China's numbers were valid. But China's data have been backed by counts of excess deaths during the period of the pandemic, as the New York Times illustrated in a recent article. Actually, this is old news. The validity of China's numbers, as shown by counts of excess deaths, was validated long ago in a February 2021 study by a group at Oxford University and the Chinese Center for Disease Control and Prevention. This was published in the prestigious British Medical Journal and is discussed in detail in the United States. Clearly, China put the saving of lives above the advance of the economy with its dynamic zero-COVID policy. but contrary to what was believed in the West at the time, saving lives also turned out to be better for the economy, as shown in the numerous data from the World Bank. During the first year of the pandemic, that is 2020, China's economy continued to grow, albeit at a slower rate. In contrast, the US economy contracted dramatically, dropping all the way back not simply to 2019 levels, but to pre-2018 levels. Interestingly, the plot also shows the year that the Chinese gross domestic product based on purchasing power parity, or PPP, surpassed that of the United States in 2017, heralding a new era for the Global South. The World Bank has not yet released data for 2021, but the International Monetary Fund, IMF, has. Purchasing power parity, gross domestic product data for 2021. The US economy grew at 5.97%, compared to China's 8.02%. Unlike the World Bank data shown in a graph for the years up to 2020, these data for 2021 are not corrected for inflation, which for 2021 ran at 4.7% in the United States, whereas China's inflation rate was 0.85%. So China's growth would be even greater in comparison to the United States, where inflation taken into account. Bottom line is that for the first 2 years of the pandemic through to 2021, China's economic growth was always positive and greater than that of the United States. China's policy not only saved lives but protected the economy. One might say win-win. Is China's dynamic zero COVID policy sustainable in the face of the Omicron variant? The period of the recent Shanghai lockdown, which we can date from 1st of April 2022, ending on 1st of June, and followed the second largest outbreak in China since the original outbreak in January of 2020 in Wuhan. Each resulted in major lockdowns. The first in Wuhan lasted about 76 days, and the second lockdown in Shanghai lasted about 60 days. The first in Wuhan was due to the original variant, and the second lockdown was due to the much more infectious Omicron variant. During the recent lockdown in Shanghai, the Western press was awash with proclamations, all too many laced with the unseemingly schadenfreude that China's dynamic zero-COVID policy was not sustainable. This is all too reminiscent of decades of predictions that China's extraordinary success in developing its economy to number one in the world in terms of purchasing power parity, or PPP, and gross domestic product GDP was a passing phase, a Ponzi scheme that was, what else, not sustainable. Recently, the same press has gone silent, always a sign that China has met with success. So what are the results? The Shanghai lockdown ended on 1st of June this year, and from that day until the day of this writing, 19th of June, there have been no deaths due to COVID-19 on the Chinese mainland. Cases nationwide are also way down to 183 per day from the peak of 26,000 on 15th of April. That was the largest number of cases in a single day for the entire period of the pandemic in China. For comparison, the peak in the United States was 800,000 in a single day. Both the Wuhan and Shanghai lockdowns demanded sacrifices and patience over the roughly two-month period for each. However, these difficulties are generally exaggerated in the West and based on anecdotes of the worst of the difficulties encountered. Such sordid journalism reaches rock bottom in a New York Times piece equating China's hard-working healthcare workers to murderers. As an antidote to this kind of hit piece and to gain a feeling of life in the cities that were under lockdown during the Wuhan outbreak, Peter Hessler's March 2020 account in The New Yorker, Life on Lockdown in China, is enlightening and will dispel many misconceptions. Peter Hessler, was living and teaching in Chengdu in Sichuan province at the time. China's approach has succeeded, and the public health measures that have worked so well in mainland China should not be lightly dismissed, let alone be the subject of mean-spirited attacks. Such measures may be means of saving millions of lives when the next variant or the next pandemic strikes. Turning again to the United States, what does it say when one of the richest nations in the world, spending more than $1 trillion a year on its national security budget, could not muster the means to deal with COVID-19 and ended up with more deaths than any other nation on Earth? China's handling of the coronavirus pandemic certainly shows a completely different outcome was possible. The US death toll was not an inescapable act of nature. That being so, should there not be a people's tribunal to investigate those in charge of the US government over the course of three administrations? That is what's needed, not an official whitewash. And should not punishment appropriate for a crime against humanity be meted out? The 1 million dead Americans deserve no less.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulema's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
I believe that having only one attribute or feature of Prophet Muhammad would lead a person to a religious life. This means to act like the Prophet in life. For instance, Prophet Muhammad used to say salam when he reached the people, whether young or old. This means to imitate Prophet Muhammad in all aspects of our life.
اگر کسی به خاطر که شبیه پیغمبر بشه همین رفتار پیغمبر رو تو زندگی خودش جاری
If we practice to live like Prophet Muhammad, which is of course a difficult task, then we will have a religious life. Of course, living like Prophet Muhammad is not easy. For instance, if we say salam and we hear no answer, we must not lose our hope. If we say salam and we hear no answer, the angels of Allah will answer our salams. So, to live like the Prophet is not easy, but we must do our best to have a religious life like that of Prophet Muhammad. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Din al-Islam, din al-Azam, ghayru din Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We are going to talk about the rules of Hajj, in fact, according to Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasis, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, as always, our guest speaker in the studio. Sheikh Javid, since we are talking about, the rules of Hajj Tamattu, and more in particular, we were talking about, we started, in fact, our episode from the last, previous episode onward, about the prohibitions of Ihram. Let's continue some of these, prohibitions or those things which are not allowed for any pilgrims to Mecca. Would you?
Yes, sure. We have already discussed some of the prohibitions, and of course, the one of the things which is prohibited for a pilgrim is, especially for women, is to apply collyrium, which is called surma. Okay. It's not permissible for a woman or for a man to apply collyrium or surma.
Yes.
For example, men, women tend to wear makeup and wear, collyrium, mascara, and different things. Yeah. And they might want to apply lotion or things like that, which is not permissible, of course. Yes, if you want to apply sunscreen, it does not have fragrance. There's mm-hmm. no objection because you want to protect your skin. Okay,
right.
That's okay because in the hot season you can do that.
But what about some of the ointment for medical purposes?
That's also permissible mm-hmm. if there's ointment and of course you want to apply it. There is no objection to you in doing so. Then we have looking in mirror. Okay, in a mirror, there are mirrors here and there. Especially when you want to enter a hotel or a restaurant and there are mirrors in front of you. And these rules are applicable to, Shia Muslims. Sunnis might not have these restrictions, okay?
Right.
So they might want to look into mirrors. That is what we need to know. And we as Shia Muslims need to follow the religious authorities we have. And of course, in this program, we are discussing the rules according to the fatwa or the verdicts of His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei. So looking in a mirror is not permissible. And if a person happens to look in a mirror, he has to pay the penalty or the kafara. Then we have wearing shoes. Wearing shoes is not permissible for men.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there are special slippers or flip-flops which a man should wear. So the upper part of the shoes and the feet must not be covered. You cannot wear socks. You must wear special flip-flops and in order to avoid covering your feet. So
yeah, but these shoes, most of these shoes are sewn.
No,
you know?
That's not called clothing. You know, it is, of course. You need to wear something. Footwear is necessary. You can walk barefooted, but if you want to wear something, you should wear something which does not cover your feet.
Uh-huh.
Okay, the upper part of your, or the upper sole of your foot.
Yeah, the sole. Yeah.
The sole should not be covered.
I see.
Then lying is absolutely forbidden. It's always forbidden, but lying, especially in the for a pilgrim, is absolutely forbidden. Quarreling is forbidden. No one has a right to quarrel with other pilgrims while performing Hajj, because it is a season. It is an occasion for reuniting, for showing
for peace and prosperity.
And
yes.
Prosperity, sure. So quarreling is forbidden. Killing lice or other, you know, insects found on the humans. Okay, if you find any insects on your body, walking, like for example, if there are cockroaches, or if there are lice, or if there are insects, flies. Okay,
mosquitoes, yeah. Flies. Yeah,
yeah. You cannot kill them. You should just simply push them aside.
Okay, drive them away.
Yeah, and killing insects, animals will make atonement obligatory.
I see.
And then beautifying oneself, okay? I did say that wearing makeup is not permissible. Beautifying oneself, wearing jewelry, wearing adornments or things like that is absolutely forbidden, and no one can do it.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's take another break or a short break here. And we'll be back and continue our program. Some of these rules regarding the prohibitions of Ihram here on RIB English Radio. Don't go away.
La ilaha illallah, Allahu Akbar.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. We are talking about the rules of prohibitions of Ihram according to Ayatollah Khamenei with Sheikh Javid. Sheikh Javid, you were talking about those rules. If there are anything left, I'd appreciate you actually to shed some light on it.
Sure. One of the prohibitions of Ihram is to apply oil. Okay, there are many pilgrims, especially Indians and Pakistanis, who are very much in the habit of applying oil, and necessary or unnecessary, they do it.
What is it for?
They apply oil to their hair, you know, to keep the to keep their hair tidy, or to keep their hair strong. And of course, applying oil has its fragrance as well.
Uh-huh.
So it's not permissible to apply oil. Oil is a term that can refer to many different things. Lotion is also included. For example, lotion is also a kind of liquid that's applied to the body. So,
but what about moisturizing, for example, the skin?
If it's not necessary, it's not permissible to of course, to use moisturizers.
Except for some medical purposes, yeah, right?
If
you have a condition, medically
unless necessary,
speaking.
Unless necessary, one should not apply right. such things. Then we have removing hair from the body. It's not permissible to pluck your hair. Ladies cannot pluck their eyebrows or pluck their hair unless the hair falls off itself by itself. Right. It's not permissible for a person, man or woman, to remove his or her hair, because you will have to wait. If you are performing Umrah, you will have to wait until you are supposed to perform Taqsir. Taqsir is when you have completed the Sa'i and you have performed the Tawaf, and then after Tawaf you will perform Taqsir. Taqsir means that you cut short your hair or your nail. That's when you are allowed to do so.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, then we have halq. Halq also means to shave, okay? Shaving is the last practice before the Tawaf al-Nisa. Of course, you are supposed to perform halq, which means that you will clean shave, or you will shave your hair, and that is when you are allowed to do so. Otherwise, before you complete the Hajj rituals, you are not allowed to pluck your hair. Then we have covering the head by males, or driving, diving in water even by females, you know. So to understand the rules better, I want to say that there are some, you know, the weather is hot there. Many people might want to take an umbrella, you know, and walk and use the umbrella to cover themselves and to walk under the shadow. Walking under the shadow is not permissible for a person who moves from the station, from Miqat, towards Mecca. Of course, once you arrive in Mecca, this restriction is removed. Okay,
right.
Because while you are walking in the streets of Mecca, okay, shadow is there. You'll walk into the hotel, but as long as you have not reached there, you cannot walk.
Use an umbrella, you mean?
You cannot use an umbrella. You cannot cover your head. You cannot wear a hat or something, or a cap, to cover your head.
Even so, despite the fact that some of these, time frames. I mean, I'm talking about the Zilhijjah time or month, which fall into the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And it becomes really extremely hot. In Saudi Arabia. So
there are two things. Of course, the weather is hot there, but we need to distinguish between covering the head and walking under the shadow. These are two different things.
Uh-huh.
Okay, sometimes there are elderly people, they always cover their head even if they are not performing Hajj. So covering the head is not permissible. It is necessary to remove the cap, to take it off and walk without wearing anything, okay?
I see.
But walking under the shadow, it's not permissible, and regardless of whether you are a man or a woman, okay? Covering the head for ladies is a must. It is obligatory. They should cover their head and hair and neck and everything,
mm-hmm.
except for their faces
right.
and hands up to the wrist. So as for walking under the shadow is concerned, of course, they cannot walk under the shadow whilst they are wearing ihram and moving towards Mecca.
I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid, for your nice elaboration and shedding light on the rules about the prohibitions of ihram here in the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم ملجا لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Strikes in Europe's transport sector have disrupted air flights and train schedules as transportation companies struggle to cope with rising demand at the start of the peak of summer travel season after COVID restrictions were lifted. A strike by staff members at Irish Airline, Ryanair, and Brussels Airlines over pay and working conditions forced the cancellation of many flights. The workers' strike also disrupted flight schedules in Spain, Italy, France, Portugal, and Belgium. Meanwhile, earlier this week, the British railway system once again came to a halt. Tens of thousands of workers have walked in Britain's biggest rail strike in 30 years, with millions of passengers facing days of chaos as both the unions and the government have stuck to their guns in a row over pay. The British Transport Union, the National Union of Rail, Maritime and Transport Workers, RMT, threatened to continue the industrial action until managers address the workers' grievances and meet their salary demands. According to the UK government career service, RMT members who are not high earners, for example train guards and track maintenance staff, earn somewhere between £20,000 to £35,000. But the union says its members deserve more. Despite the ongoing negotiations between representatives from the management and staff, the media predicted the strikes to continue. They attributed further industrial action to the rapidly rising inflation rates exacerbated by sluggish economic growth, saying this combo will likely lead to more worker strikes across the European continent in the summer ahead.
The people who are on strike have been pretty clear about it, including in Great Britain with the railroads, the airline pilots, and everybody else. For some years, they've been in trouble and there have been increasing social unrest. And what's happening now is a huge increase in inflation and hence a decrease in purchasing power, and people's standard of living is going down. And so you're having a confluence of events. You have this economic crisis, then you have this people saying, listen, we cannot let the war in Ukraine completely derail the environmental crisis. And furthermore, the policies, as another group saying, look, the policies that we're pursuing, that our governments are pursuing in Ukraine, are adding to the problem, not making it better.
Unions have said the rail strikes could mark the start of a summer of discontent, with teachers, medics, and even waste disposal workers heading for industrial action as inflation pushes 10%. Inflation has soared across Europe on the back of a major rise in energy costs, and Britain is not alone in facing strikes. Russia's war in Ukraine pushed the already rising inflation in countries that use the euro to a record high in May, with energy projected to have the steepest annual rate. As the war in Ukraine drags on through its fourth month, the West, led by US and NATO, remains largely united in backing Kiev, but they are divided over how long they're willing to endure the conflict's economic fallout. The prospect of a drawn-out conflict with the battle raging in eastern Ukraine has raised questions about whether war fatigue, coupled with skyrocketing food prices and energy bills, could test countries' political will to keep pressuring Moscow over time. In the U.S., President Joe Biden blamed the Russians for rising U.S. gas prices, saying it was outrageous what the war in Ukraine is causing. Hungary, on the other hand, has called for immediate peace talks to end the war between Ukraine and Russia, warning that a prolonged conflict will fuel an economic crisis that will imperil governments across Europe. Meanwhile, the United Nations has warned of an unprecedented global hunger crisis in light of the recent developments.
There's a couple of different things going on here. There is the United States as an outlier in NATO in a certain sense, with some of the Eastern European companies really pushing for more and more aggressive behavior by NATO in Ukraine. You have other countries which are in Western Europe who are suffering from the United States activities here, the real pressure economically, and are beginning to say, wait a minute, you know, this is not what we really want to have here. Our population's getting upset. And then you have apparently the failure of the sanctions. And in the United States press, at least, the understanding that maybe they're not going to work so well. And so the Russians are not going to be suffering so much.
Western countries rallied around Kiev when Russia began its military operation in Ukraine in February. But now that unity is being tested as soaring inflation and energy shortages rebound on their own citizens. Now, the UN Human Rights Office agrees that the veteran Palestinian journalist was killed by Israeli fire last month. The probe finds that Abu Akleh and her colleague were targeted by seemingly well-aimed bullets as they covered a military raid in the occupied West Bank.
All the information we have gathered, including official documentation from the Israeli military and the Palestinian Attorney General, is consistent with the finding that the shots that killed Abu Akleh and injured her colleague came from Israeli security forces and not from indiscriminate firing by armed Palestinians, as was initially claimed by the Israeli authorities.
So far, several media organizations have conducted their own investigations into the incident, and all have come to the same conclusion. Multiple witnesses also agreed with the probe, stating that Israeli forces shot the veteran Palestinian reporter. Meanwhile, Al Jazeera and its host country, Qatar, pointed the fingers at Israel from the outset. The UN has also confirmed that Abu Akleh was wearing a blue flak jacket marked with the word press when being shot by Israeli troops, exposing the gruesome nature of the daylight murder and suggesting that they were deliberately targeted.
As long as the United States and its allies continue to not only embrace this position, but to promote this position using every tactic at their disposal, including threats, the more that has been the case, the more the occupation is quite happy to resort to war crimes bordering on what one could also say are crimes against humanity, albeit in a very calculated move, drawn out over a period of decades, as is the case with ethnic cleansing, which if it happened over a shorter period of time, would fit very nicely with the definition of a genocide.
The killing of yet another journalist is, however, in line with the pattern of Israeli violence against reporters and other members of the media. The Palestinian Ministry of Information says at least 45 journalists have been killed by Israeli forces since 2000. Israeli brutality against Palestinians and journalists has been a topic of discussion for many years now. The regime has, however, never accepted blame for its wrongdoing, and in nearly all cases baselessly shifted the blame on Palestinians, and the case of Abu Akleh is no exception. Following the UN's report, the Israeli regime insisted that the fatal shooting of Abu Akleh was unintentional, pointing out at the same time that it had not received access to critical evidence that might determine whether she was killed by an Israeli soldier or a Palestinian gunman. Israel's military also says Palestinian authorities should hand over the bullet that killed Shireen. The demand has, however, been met by widespread criticism, with Palestinians saying the regime should hand over the gun, which is believed to have killed the journalist, as Israel can't be trusted of conducting a fair investigation of itself. The murder of Abu Akleh, which sparked global outrage, only adds to Israel's long list of atrocities against Palestinians. But that fury has yet to translate into any concrete measure, particularly by international bodies such as the UN Security Council. So far, several international organizations have provided